A midweek Wednesday, January 12th edition of Connecticut Today, right here on WICC, featured comments from Governor Ned Lamont, courtesy of the fine folks of the Connecticut Network, on another possible extension of his COVID-19 executive powers. Sacred Heart University Department of Government Professor and Chairman Dr. Gary Rose offered his thoughts on the current controversy surrounding the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. And high school sports reporter Sean Patrick Boley from GameTimeCT.com chimed in to talk about a recent high school basketball game that made local and national headlines.
One of the questions I asked today in our Facebook question of the day, which oddly enough you can find at Facebook, facebook.com/WICC600, has to do with the governor's powers, his executive powers, his superpowers, his Marvel comic superpowers during the COVID-19 pandemic. Over 2 years, you know, the governor has been given the okay, the imprimatur, by the legislative majority in the General Assembly, say, hey, you handle the stuff with the schools, with the teachers' unions, we're out of here. So now there's word the governor may want. They may want another extension of the powers. Some people think it's a fine and dandy idea because we are still in this COVID thing of ours. And it's easier for one guy, the guy in the big office with the big leather chair, to decide this stuff rather than, as they say, get it bogged down, some people would think, in the legislative process. However, there are some people who say, well, wait a minute. At what point do we say the legislature should do their jobs? And that probably varies by party. So, at an earlier press event today, a media event, Governor Ned Lamont was asked about that after the general questioning of what was going on. And the governor asked, hey, what is the deal? Will you seek and will you accept another extension of your legislative powers? He responded to that, as did the Senate Democratic leader, Martin Looney of New Haven.
Can you just clarify what are your intentions regarding the future of pandemic management in Connecticut? Are you planning to ask the legislature for an extension of the emergency declarations? Are you going to present a list of policies and initiatives that you've done, that you've implemented, that you believe should either be continued either through legislation or executive action? And if there are some that can only be done through executive action, would there be a possibility that you would require emergency powers to do things that you would not otherwise be statutorily allowed to do?
Yeah, legislature is going to be in a month, and we are preparing for the legislative leaders and legislature a list of the EOs which we think should be continued. But I'd like to have the legislative imprimatur on that. Legislature may say, I don't think we ought to be wearing masks in schools, or I don't think a store should be able to tell people, ask their vaccination status. Or they may say, I think we ought to extend this more broadly for a period of time. I think you know where I stand, but I think it's important that we all speak with one voice, Paul. And so I'd love to have the legislatures weighing in on that. So Nora Danahy's going to put together, I don't know, 10 or 12 of these executive orders. And I'd like to think the legislature will have an opportunity to vote on them or otherwise. You know, I think there's a narrow group of things going forward where it would be helpful for us to have a little agility to be able to move fast. You maybe noticed in the last couple of weeks, we had to move pretty fast to get, rapid tests. And, I could have an RFP and a long process, but that would definitely slow things up. So there are some places where I think you'd like the executive to have a narrow area where I'm able to move quickly in order to protect the public health.
Senator Looney, could I ask you your thoughts? What do you foresee? Do you foresee some sort of combination of legislative and executive action and some sort of continuation of the governor's emergency powers on a narrow and limited basis?
I think that's certainly possible and likely, Paul. I agree with the governor that there may be certain areas where it is absolutely essential to enable a quick response in a crisis that only the executive can do by issuing an executive order pursuant to emergency powers. There are other areas, I think, where the legislature can appropriately enact statutes. Certainly be interested in hearing from the governor and his chief counsel about what areas they would like us to legislate in. But I think it'll continue to be a cooperative effort as it has been. I think the governor has done a fine job in using his emergency powers to this point. He has been judicious and restrained in them and has not abused them in the almost two years since the first emergency order went into effect.
Okay.
All right. So there you go. There is a comment there from Martin Looney, Democrat in New Haven, longtime New Haven Democratic State Senator, as to what his feelings are as to an extension of the governor's executive powers, which, and look, face it, it is easier when you have one person doing it. It is easier. I guess the question here is, when, and who knows what the answer is to that? I don't know what the answer is to that. Is it a number of cases? Is it a hospitalization number? Is it a mortality number? I mean, is it, what is the scenario of when the legislators here in the state finally say, okay, we want more of a hand in this? Now, again, remember, keep in the back of your minds, or in the front if there's more room there, keep in the back of your minds that this is an election year. And it is probably beneficial to some legislators to insulate themselves on being the bad guys or the bad gals. No matter what your chosen gender is, if you're bad, you're bad. You want to insulate yourself from doing stuff and going on record and giving testimony at the Capitol or raising your right hand or your left hand or whatever hand you want to raise and swear to something or vote on something that you think is going to cause you, electoral support as soon as this coming November. So I'm guessing the entire Democratic caucus, although there's supposedly are some fractures in the Democratic caucus, particularly among the Black and Hispanic members. I know last time there was a little, there wasn't complete unanimity above this. It was close. But, you're looking at a scenario here where more likely than not, the governor's going to get an extension of this again, probably leaning toward the summer. Who knows? But as Senator Looney said, the legislature will be back at it in about a month, middle of February. So we gave you that. If you want to weigh in on that, you can. 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. Do you not buy the notion that it slows things down precipitously if you involve the legislature? Can't the legislature just come in and within a few hours just vote on something? I mean, look, let's put it this way. If the Democrats support the governor and what he wants to do, just every Democrat vote yes, and it'll pass. It'll pass in an hour or 2 hours. But is it the fact that they don't want to put their names on this stuff? Because it's not like this is a 50-50 chamber here. Okay, we're not talking about this is not like the U.S. Senate. 50-50 and the VP breaks the ties here. The Democrats have decided advantages in the General Assembly in both chambers. So come on in and vote yes, unless they're afraid to vote yes on some things. So that was the governor earlier today when he was asked about extending his executive powers. Right now, though, one of our go-to folks we'd like to check in with on a monthly basis. This gentleman informs us of his opinions on all things politics, local, national, and worldwide. And I suspect the last week or so was a good, they love to say teachable moments sometimes. I suspect we've had some of those. Sacred Heart University Department of Government Professor and Chairman Dr. Gary Rose is with us. Gary, Happy New Year. Good to hear from you. How are you?
Good, Paul. I'm doing well, and Happy New Year to you as well.
Well, thank you, Gary. We appreciate the time, as always. And I'm guessing that with all this talk about the filibuster and what to do and a carve out and a carve in and special circumstances here and there, your students must be a wonder at what they see here.
Yeah, well, we start classes next week, but I'm sure that my students, who I know follow what's going on in politics, are probably somewhat bewildered over all of these efforts on the part of the president and his party to alter Senate rules. And you know what is really quite amazing is when you go back and look at the record. I mean, the president himself, as well as members of his party, were all in favor of the filibuster. Many of them are actually on record, and a good number of them are still in the Senate supporting the filibuster. But now, when it pertains to an issue which, at least in theory, could benefit them, then all of a sudden they want to do away with this longstanding Senate tradition, which really does not speak highly of our political process right now inside the Beltway.
And, you know, Gary, a lot of people say, well, the filibuster came from slavery and this and the other, and it was never really supposed to be there. But I think, Gary, no matter what, and as you say, both parties use it, the Senate is supposed to advance stuff that makes sense, at least in some way, with some modicum of support. It doesn't take a lot, but some modicum of support from the opposition party, whichever party that is. It's supposed to force better legislation to get there and, frankly, quell a lot of the crazy ideas that come out of the House.
Well, that's very true. And that's why 60 votes, you know, are required to terminate a filibuster, because the whole theory here, I mean, and it's true, it does have somewhat controversial roots, this Senate tradition, as you note. But, you know, if you do get 60 votes, that means that you are at least, you know, appealing somewhat to the opposing party, and you're forging some type of consensus. And so that's really one of the great, attributes of this Senate tradition, is that it forces some compromise and it forces some bipartisanship.
Dr. Gary Rose is the guest. Gary, hang on. We'll be right back with you. First, traffic and weather together right here on the button, 336 on a midweek Wednesday at WICC. And our monthly check-in with Dr. Gary Rose, chair of the Politics and Government Department at Sacred Heart University in Fairfield, talking about all the stuff going on in D.C. and this ongoing now discussion about whether or not to eliminate the filibuster, change the Senate rules, do a carve-out for this voting bill, whichever voting bill they try to push here. And Gary, it's interesting, this is happening because they are pushing a voting rights bill, which I see now as being kind of rephrased. They don't use the word voting rights anymore, because I think that makes people a little like, well, don't we have voting rights? You know, voting reform here. You know, Gary, I went and looked at some of the things, Gary, in this bill, which are, you know, in some way a response to what happened during the Trump years. And some of these things, you know, make sense. Some of them, it's like 50-50. And there are some of these things in these voting rights bills, Gary, that you would look at and say, well, wait a minute. Isn't this big footing the states' rights under how elections have always been run? And I don't think, Gary, that the common person understands some of the things that are in this bill.
Yeah, the bill is just laced with controversial components, for sure. You know, we could go through a good number of them, but, you know, you mentioned the states versus the federal government when it comes to voting procedures and voting laws. And although the federal government has over the years, you know, gotten somewhat involved in states' rights, you know, in terms of extending voting rights mm-hmm. to African Americans and women and persons who are 18 years of age and over. And, you know, through constitutional amendment, we have also eliminated, you know, the poll tax and so forth. And so the federal government hasn't been completely, you know, outside of voting rights. But although those amendments that I just mentioned were approved by the states, But for the most part, you're absolutely correct. I mean, if you go through the powers of Congress in Article 1, Section 8, you don't find that the Congress has control, the federal government, that is, over voting procedures. Those belong to the states under the 10th Amendment. You know, the powers not delegated to the federal government nor prohibited to the states are therefore reserved to the states respectively. That's what the 10th Amendment says. And so voting rights historically has really been the province of state legislatures, governors, you know, and we make the laws to process our elections. And so that's why this voting rights bill that they are promoting, if in fact it ever got passed, and I don't see how that's going to happen going back to our discussion with the filibuster, but if it ever did by chance get passed, I really feel that the Supreme Court would probably strike it down as being an unconstitutional violation of states' rights.
And Gary, if people feel that they are being wronged because of their ethnicity or their national origin, or there are repressive voting laws passed in states, well, they have redress through, as you mentioned, the federal system because of laws that have been passed. And, you know, there are any number of agencies or interest groups that would file federal lawsuits in that situation.
Oh, there would be many federal lawsuits, and that's where the courts come in. You know, they are really the great arbiters, and they would address, I think, some of these grievances, and that's where those grievances could be resolved. And yes, I mean, the Voting Rights Act of 1965 I should have mentioned that earlier, was certainly a big development in terms of promoting, you know, African-American participation in voter registration. But nevertheless, that said, so many other aspects of our elections are managed by the states. And if, in fact, there are grievances that emerge in various states, and inevitably there will be and there have been, then those issues should go into court, and that's where the court enters into it. But this is not the domain of the Congress and the president. It just historically and traditionally is not legally. It's not really. It's not really within their purview.
Dr. Gary Rose is the guest, our monthly check-in with all things politics and government. And Gary, let's segue from this to the president. Mr. Biden, boy, I tell you, he is really facing an onslaught here between the continued COVID cases, unrest in his own party. And now you see, Gary, these economic numbers that came out. I mean, the inflation, I wonder if he's sitting back in the Oval Office saying, well, you know, should I have really done this? It'll probably get better on all fronts, but he's really getting banged up now, isn't he?
Oh, he really is. And so much of it is due to, you know, the promises he made when he was running for president, you know, that he was going to eliminate the virus. And that's, of course, been shown time and time again. And furthermore, he was supposed to govern from the center, and he was going to address the soul of America, and he was going to bring the parties together because, you know, this is working class Joe from Scranton, you know. But the reality is that the country has been more divided under this president. The economy, as you say, is a problem, but there are other issues too. His rhetoric has been very divisive and incendiary, and all people have to do is watch that speech he made in Georgia
yesterday,
and you would see a president who is doing very little to accommodate Americans who disagree with him.
That's not the Joe Biden that you and I heard for 30 or 40 years in the Senate. That's not him.
No, it's not him at all, and it shows that in many ways, he has capitulated to the left wing of his party, the progressive wing. And I know you and I have spoken about this before, and they have pulled him in that direction in a big way. And he feels very beholden to them. And he's appealing really not even to the moderate base of his party anymore, but really to the progressive far left wing of his party. And it really it's really quite amazing to see how, within the space of 1 year, how he just really, I don't want to say transformed himself, but how he just really did not live up to you know, what a lot of Americans felt he was going to do. And that's why there's a lot of problems, as you already say, within his own party, too, because he has not united the party by any means.
Final question, Gary, I have to ask you this. You know, I kept seeing all these stories online. I said, let me try something here. So I go into the address bar of my computer browser and I type in Hillary Clinton 2024. And I don't get like wacky left wing stuff. I'm getting stories from mainstream news outlets saying, hey, why not? Is this a why not, Gary? I mean, can you imagine? I mean, stranger things have happened.
Oh, I think it's very possible. Wall Street Journal had an op-ed today on that. In fact, yes. And I think it's a very distinct possibility. And Hillary Clinton is revered by many within her party. The interesting thing about Hillary Clinton and her husband, too, of course, is really an icon within the party. But the Clintons can bring together that party. And actually, she could probably do quite well again, I think, in a Democratic nominating contest, regardless of who her opponent would be. And so I don't think it's all that far-fetched for one moment. And Hillary, of course, you know, has felt that she was denied the presidency, which she always, it seems like, you know, believes she's entitled to. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if Hillary Clinton actually starts to make her move after the midterm elections.
Boy, there's a whole semester's syllabus for you right there. You imagine that with your students. Yeah. Dr. Gary Rose, chair and professor of the Government Department, Sacred Heart University. Gary, good to speak with you. We'll speak next month. Thanks.
Okay, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Dr. Gary Rose there. Oh, folks, hey, let's do it, huh? Come on, let's do it. Hillary 2024. That should be the, you know what her campaign should be? Hillary 2024. Why the hell not? First, though, I wanted to bring this gentleman back online, first time of the new year, because a lot of people still, and I have still people asking me about it here on the show and walking around the building here about that. You know, that girls' basketball game the other day between Sacred Heart and Lyman Hall in Wallingford, 92-4, you probably saw it already. You saw it numerous times. And the minute I saw the score, I went, this is going to reverberate here. Sean Patrick Bowley is the guest. He's been on before. He's the assistant sports editor and producer at GameTimeCT.com, which is, of course, published also and run under the CT Insider masthead. Hey, Sean, it's Paul. Happy New Year. How are you?
I'm great. How you doing, Paul? Thanks for having me on again.
Oh, my pleasure, Sean. Look, it's been hashed around over what the Sacred Heart coach did and things that were said and everybody's thinking as to how this might have happened. But so let's stay away from that. But when you saw that score, did you react the way I did? And I didn't even see, like, it took me a second to focus on who the teams were. The minute I saw 92-4, I went, oh, this isn't going to go over well. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think I'm with you on that. You know, there are certain numbers when you juxtapose them against each other. What that's going to look like? You know, I don't know what the threshold is really about this. But when you see a 94 on one side, you see a 4 on the other. You know, your spidey sense starts tingling, and you're like, oh boy. And that's exactly what happened to a lot of guys, a lot of other reporters, and a lot of other people around the state, and you know, set off a fiery debate. For at least a couple of weeks, and it still continues. It's been going on for as long as I can, you know, been covering sports, you know, how much is too much and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and let's, again, set aside the individuals here because we've debated that and guys have written and you and the coverage has been good about this all over the state. But the question that I get a lot, Sean, and having covered high schools and colleges on the side here for 20 or 30 years, the question I hear from people is, how is that possible, let alone the conduct of a coach? But I guess sometimes, Sean, people see this occasionally in basketball, not too bad, occasionally in football. But the question I've been getting is, hey, how is that possible? Is there that big of a gap in talent that would allow this?
Yeah, you know what? I think my short answer is yes. There certainly is a big talent gap. You know, especially when you're talking about a school like a Sacred Heart or, you know, maybe down Fairfield County way, you know, Notre Dame Fairfield, which is coached by Maria Conlin, and other Catholic, you know, private schools. there certainly is a lot more chances of that happening, where you get a group of kids coming in there. They want to play at a high level. They're with the team. They want to play with other like-minded girls. You know, parents talk to each other in AAU or things like that, and they all kind of want to play together, and they find an opportunity in a Catholic school like that. And that kind of sets off the debate, well, should the Catholic schools be playing against some of the public schools? But then there's also instances where, you know, some kids might want to go to go to public schools to play, you know, if they choose to. And that happens, certainly. So it's not just a Catholic school thing. It's always a little bit easier as far as just paying straight-up tuition to go to a Catholic school or a private school, not just Catholic. But, like, Maria Conlon did that, like, 20-something years ago. You remember? She was at Derby.
Yeah.
She was living in Derby, and she went to Seymour, and she paid tuition to go there to do so. So, you know, that certainly happened. But as far as, like, the gap goes, I mean, we talk about this in our meetings all the time among sports staff, and I think that we agree that there is just – there are certain towns and certain schools that don't take it seriously as the school, other schools. But unfortunately, when you get them all kind of mixed up into the same league, you can certainly get a disparity. You know, that happens. They try to – teams and leagues try to, you know, make equitable schedules. But at the end of the day, you just can't prevent it, I think.
And Sean, I know certain levels of sport try to do it too, depending upon where it is. You know, with co-op teams where, okay, there may be two or three kids or guys or girls who are on that level here, but there's not enough to form a team. And you see that a lot in hockey and even in football now, very, very competitive sports, very expensive sports. So does the co-op thing work in your mind? Does it maintain a fair level of competition?
Yeah, but then you start to fundamentally change, like, the dynamics of a team. I mean, I know there are a lot of teams that are small schools in football, say, and then they run up against one of these co-op teams that are, you know, from a number of small schools. They didn't have enough infrastructure to form a team, so they kind of get together. I think Coggenshaug up in Durham did that, has done that, and then they play a team like a Morgan or something like that, which doesn't have a co-op. Mm-hmm. And then they start to go, well, wait a minute, what about us? So we're a small school too, you know, and so on and so forth. So it does help. It helps give opportunities. I think that's what the CIC wants to do with co-ops. You know, give kids in certain towns who are just, you know, by the unfortunate geography, may not have a school that plays or that plays a certain sport, football, hockey, obviously a huge one. I mean, you're also talking about rink availability and things like that. So that's, in that sense, you know, co-ops are good, but, you know, as with anything else, it might be in moderation because you get to a certain point where you're like, now you're fundamentally changing. They're starting these small school powerhouses and what constitutes a small school. And I mean, these are just, it's an interesting thing. I don't know if you'd see that in basketball though, because it only takes five, you know,
sure,
players on the court at a time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not really a solution here.
Sean Patrick Boley is the guest. Sean, hang on. We'll be right back with you. First, traffic and weather together right here. It's a Wednesday on WICC. Sean Patrick Boley with us for a few more minutes. Sean is the assistant sports editor and producer at GameTimeCT.com. Check it out for all the high school coverage in, to, and through the Fairfield, New Haven counties and areas and all over the state. And, Sean, boy, what a tragedy, something that's really gone worldwide, the tragic death of Teddy Balkin, the St. Luke's hockey player. And now, Sean, there's the question of the use or the enforcement of a rule for, you know, neck protection. And you and I both know, having covered the sport, a lot of people may not know, the neck protection that is available is not solid. You could still get an orthopedic injury, but some of these neck bands that you can wear have Teflon in them, which does not allow a skate blade to cut, you know, a vessel or a vein. But now I guess, Sean, the controversy is, are players wearing this and is this being enforced?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of those things that you don't really even think about until, you know, something tragic and awful like this happens. And, you know, that's the furthest thing I'd ever thought about when I go to a skating rink is everyone wearing their neck guards. And, you know, it's certainly a piece of equipment that is, you know, required to be used. But I think for the most part, everyone's kind of got a little blasé about it, you know, and I mean everybody. I mean, it's just one of those things you don't think about. You don't really see a lot of injuries or something as horrible as this happening.
Mm-hmm.
So in that regard, you know, I think, you know, if there is something that is good to come out of something horrific like this, It's that there's going to be a little bit more or heightened awareness. And I think there are a lot more. You're going to see a lot more players want to do that, and I think you're going to see at the maybe even higher levels. Maybe this is a good idea. We should start enforcing this. I know the NCAA doesn't really have. It's more of a recommendation. It's not quite a. It's not quite a rule that goes for the prep schools that they were the St. Luke's is a part of. It's not, you know, they play by the NCAA rules. So the CIAC and the NFHS, they require them. As far as I know, they require them. But I think now you're just going to see kind of a little bit more enforcement of that, or even just a little bit more awareness of this is something that, you know, we can prevent serious injury and or death if we make sure we wear them. It's not totally cumbersome. You know, I can get it. That might be annoying, but, you know, I think it's a small price to pay.
Yeah, absolutely. And boy, I got to tell you, Sean, when things like this happen, you and I have been covering the sport for years. No community really reacts to something like this, Sean, like the hockey community does. And not saying one community is better than the other, but my God, you had tributes for Teddy all the way on up to the National Hockey League. It was amazing to see.
Yeah, it seems like the more intimate the sport, you know, the more you see things like this. Hockey is certainly, you know, not as, you know, I mean, certainly all, like you said, all communities would react the same way. But, you know, you would see this at a higher level than stuff like hockey because it's an intimate sport. There's not as many people playing it, so they kind of circle the wagons around. It's a little bit more noticeable, and you'll see it at the higher levels certainly as well. I mean, I think lacrosse is another sport that's kind of like that and so on. So, you know, wrestling is another one. But, yeah, it's amazing to see. You know, and it was immediately Sam Rosen on the Rangers broadcast heard about it because it was so close and heard about it and sent his condolences and their best wishes to everybody. And, you know, and that was great. So that just kind of kickstarted. Next thing you know, you've seen, you know, all the hockey teams, the NHL teams putting their sticks out for Teddy.
Finally, Sean, we just wrapped up another football season here in the state and the CIAC all around the state. Any thoughts out of this season? Was there anything that came out of this season all around the state, Fairfield County, New Haven County, that is going to initiate any change? Did the CIAC, you know, coming off COVID and getting pretty much a full season in, anything of note that was an aha moment from this season or not?
I think what we did learn was, especially during this pandemic, there was some there were definitely some things that went wrong. You know, there were some disruption, I should say. There were a bunch of teams that had to cancel a few games, but it was at midseason it got kind of sketchy. A little scary there. Where are we going to be able to finish the season? And you know, this was obviously before the Omicron variant hit and that spike went up. The fact that we were able to get through it, I think, you know, with little. Very few incidents. I think the fact that we were able to get through it is bodes well for the future. And I think that the decision makers were right in letting things kind of go. I think that was a really good thing. I'm glad we got through it. You know, the one thing I did take from the season was, you know, that year off really, really, you know, set a lot of our kids back. You know, a lot of the players back, a lot of development back. Linemen were skinny. You know, maybe they weren't, lifting with their, you know, the motivation wasn't there.
Or eating after practice.
Yeah, things like that. Or maybe even they were too big, you know. But I think now with, you know, not getting a summer workout, not getting a spring football season, which the CIAC got rid of and didn't bring back, that was kind of that didn't really help. And, you know, we just picked up after like 1.5 years after being left off. And, they had a little bit of a workout, you know, some of the schools and districts and things like that had some during the 7-on-7 in 2020, but it just wasn't the same and wasn't football, especially for a poor lineman. But, I think now we can finally get back to regular order as far as, you know, getting our workouts and getting development in. But otherwise, I thought that the season went off pretty well.
I got to ask you one last thing. I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but is Fairfield County, Sean, the Southeastern Conference of Connecticut? is Fairfield County and the FCAC and all those schools, is that our own SEC or not?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, in football or in all?
No, football. Football, yeah.
Yeah. No, it certainly is. Like Fairfield County is, as far as like CIAC goes, I mean, they certainly had a great year, Southern Connecticut and Southeastern Connecticut. Sorry, Southwestern Connecticut, Fairfield County, had a great year. They didn't quite win as many championships as we thought, which was kind of interesting. I think we had a little bit of the revenge of the Central Connecticut Conference with Maloney winning and, you know, Windsor knocking off St. Joe. So, but I thought, like, I thought it was great. I liked the variety. A lot of guys were, like, kind of mocking, you know, yelling at me, like, oh, you go, you don't believe in the old CCC. But, you know, I thought it was really well spread out. You had Killingly winning, and, you know, you had Cromwell-Portland winning, and you know, and obviously at the highest level, Darien beating Fairfield Prep. I thought that was great. But yeah, Fairfield County had a great year. Didn't quite get all the championships that it wanted. But hey, what are you going to do? You can't win them all, right?
That's right. Sean Patrick Boldy from Game Time CT. Check it out, Game Time CT in the ConnecticutInsider.com section. Sean, good to speak with you, and we'll chat down the road. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Sean Patrick Boley there. Check it out, ctinsider.com/GameTimeCT for all the high school coverage around the state.